is Greater LA. I'm Steve Chiotakis. It's KCRW's show that connects you to the people and the places of Southern California. Today, we're taking you to the border, to the Mexican side of the international crossing between Tijuana and San Diego. Yeah, it's not really Greater LA, but it is a place that is becoming more and more familiar to many Angelenos, because so many residents of LA have moved south to Mexico, by choice or by deportation. Or in the case of some former LA residents, such as 17-year-old Lupe Felix, both.
Okay, so my name's Guadalupe. I'm here at the Chaparral to cross to San Diego. Right now there's a lot of people trying to cross. Everyone's rushing to get to the line first.
Earbuds in, her body weighed down by a big backpack, Lupe whizzes up the concrete ramp at one of Tijuana's border crossings. She hustles down this long walkway past older, slower border crossers, hoping to avoid the long line to enter the United States. And she does this every day, twice a day, just to get to school and back home. Yeah, it's not what she imagined last year when she was a junior at Mendez High School in Boyle Heights.
My senior year was supposed to be like prom and like hanging out with friends and like family and like having like my graduation party.
That dream faded when Lupe's mom had visa issues. She went to Mexico to settle her legal status, and then she got stuck there and not allowed back into the United States. Well, when reporter Jesse Hardman learned that Lupe was joining her mom in Tijuana for her senior year of high school, he handed her a digital recorder to document the experience.
In the summer of 2017, Lupe's mom, Amalia, went to Juarez, Mexico, to try and resolve a visa issue. She says she was accused of lying in her interview with U.S. authorities. They said she'd have to wait 10 years before applying again.
And she called me and she was like, "Oh, we have bad news. They denied my papers, I won't be able to go home. Your dad's gonna stay here for a while. We're gonna figure out if we could somehow appeal and let's see what happens."
Lupe and her dad are U.S. citizens, but her mom's status was more complicated. Her parents headed to Zacatecas, Mexico to live with family and decide next steps, and Lupe spent her junior year of high school in Los Angeles living by herself in the family home.
Most of the days I was sleeping alone in my house, so those were the tough times. So me knowing that I would have my parents home with me wherever that may be was a real relief for me.
Last summer, Lupe left Mendez High School in Boyle Heights here in Los Angeles, the only home she'd ever known, and moved to Tijuana to meet up with her parents. Living near the border meant Lupe could enroll in a new high school in San Diego. She started recording some audio diaries as she figured out her new reality, which included getting up at the crack of dawn.
"Hey, people. It's me, Lupe. It's currently 5:43 in the morning. Ready to head out. Today I woke up at 4. Got dressed. Brushed my teeth. Today there wasn't enough time for me to eat. Right now, the taxi is coming to pick me up so I can go to the border."
Moving senior year is tough. Most peers already have history and friends at their schools. Lupe wasn't alone in commuting across the border. She noticed other students doing it too and helping each other out by saving spots in the immigration line. But they didn't invite her in. She found confidants and friends in teachers who knew her situation and had done the cross-border commute for school themselves. Teachers like Betsy Jimenez.
"I remember that I would go back home probably like at 7:30. We'll get there very tired because of the traffic. We were always hungry. We were always stressed. And then after making our meals and eating, we had to do homework, but we were so tired by then. So sometimes I would lie to my mom and I would say that I didn't have any homework. And then you had to wake up so early again the next morning."
Lupe's mom, Amalia, feels bad that her daughter wound up in the situation she's in.
"Y aquí estoy.
My daughter's paying the consequences for my mistakes, Amalia says.
Es la que está pagando las consecuencias.
But Lupe tells her mom, don't worry.
I don't really want her to feel that way. I don't know, I just don't want her to feel that way. Because at the end of the day, it was my decision to move.
Sus celebraciones yo no las puedo ver.
Amaya says she's upset that she's missing important events in her daughter's life. She won't be able to go to Lupe's graduation. Lupe says she wasn't able to have the prom she imagined either. She convinced her former principal back in L.A. to let her attend her old school's big dance.
I wore a red dress with thick straps. It was sparkly. And then I let my hair down, curly. And I did red eyeshadow.
Lupe knows she's in uncharted territory as she heads towards college. She's attending San Diego State University in the fall. Her mom was taken out of school in third grade to help raise her siblings, and her dad never went to school. He started working when he was 6 years old.
Seeing that no one in my family has ever pursued their career because of obstacles they have to overcome or adjust drives me to, like, be the one to be the example and break the cycle of just dropping out. I will eventually, get my own house. I will be financially stable where I could help my family or do whatever I need to do.
Lupe's goals were challenged this past year in many ways, but she says nothing was going to stop her, not even a border.
I don't know, the feeling of, not being able to do anything about, my situation or others, of, they're going to similar stuff, as me. Or even worse, because I could still cross. My mom can't. She's a strong woman. She doesn't show it, but I know she's sad. I don't get angry. I just get frustrated. Because to me, the border isn't necessary, I guess. I don't know. To me, it's just an imaginary line that we have to cross every day.
Lupe Felix says she plans to study social work and journalism in the fall. She's going to live in San Diego, but spend her weekends back in Tijuana helping out her parents. For KCRW, I'm Jesse Hardman.
And by the way, Jesse is an L.A.-based reporter and journalism teacher. He worked with Lupe Felix as part of the Boyle Heights Beat, which is a teen-led community media outlet. Just ahead, an update on Santa Anita, where two more horses died over the weekend. The calls for the track to suspend the season are now louder. The latest is next. You're listening to Greater LA on KCRW.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiatakis. The California Horse Racing Board has asked the Santa Anita racetrack to cancel the remainder of its season. It was a request that the track denied, despite the fact that two more horses died at that track over the weekend. Veterinarians had to euthanize a gelding named Formal Dude on Saturday, and then another horse, Truffolino, reportedly died of a heart attack yesterday. Now, that brings the total to 29 horses that have died since the track opened for the season just before the new year. John Sherva follows the sport of horse racing for the LA Times, and he's with us right now. Hi, John.
Hello. How are you?
I'm well. What happened over the weekend? Tell us about these two horses and how they passed away.
Well, number 28, Formal Dude, suffered a pelvic injury which is actually very unusual. I mean, I think it happens in less than 4% of the fatalities with horses. That night, Saturday night, the CHRB, the California Horse Racing Board, called Belinda Stronach of the Stronach Group, which owns Santa Anita, and says, we would like you to shut down. And she, after consulting with others, said, no, we're going to keep running. And then on Sunday, again, as you mentioned, Truffalina suffered what was a heart attack. It wasn't a catastrophic injury. The horse was not euthanized. The horse just died. And obviously they have to do the necropsy to confirm a heart attack, but generally that's what it is when a horse goes down. So there are six more racing days, Friday through Sunday, for the next two weekends, which will total, 28 to 30 races each weekend. Then the racing moves to Los Alamitos for 2.5 weeks and then goes to Del Mar.
Go through with me the protocol in a situation like this, because this is the California Horse Racing Board that asked the track to close, the owners of the track. They said no. Can the track do that, or is there any regulation involved here?
Well, you hit on the right word. It's the CHRB is a regulatory agency. It is not like a commissioner's office. It's not like MLB or NFL or any of those things. There is no commissioner. It is simply their job to regulate, to enforce the rules of the state of California. Now, they do have the power to shut down a track or to move races from a track, but they have to go through the regulatory process, which includes a 10-day public notice hearing and the publishing of an agenda. So technically, they could still maybe impact the races in 2 weeks, but they would have to go through a 10-day waiting period. That's all likely going to change later this year when a bill goes through the House, through the Assembly, that would give the CHRB almost instant power to shut down the track. So what they can do now is they'd have to go through the 10-day waiting period. What they might be able to do next year is actually do shut it down.
Is that legislation, John, in direct result to what's going on at Santa Anita?
Yes. Yeah. It was introduced earlier this year, and I think it's pretty sure it's already passed the Senate, but it still has to go to the Assembly. And it has been endorsed by Governor Newsom.
What is it that the track says it's doing? Because I think the company that owns the track said they want to see these reforms through. What kind of reforms are they talking about in denying the request from the board to close?
Well, the major part of their reforms deal with race day medication. And what they've done is, by basically declaring house rules, lowered the amount of Lasix from the race day Lasix from 10 cc's to 5 cc's. Now, Lasix is a drug that is partially a diuretic, and it's used to treat exercise-induced pulmonary hemorrhaging, which, of course, is bleeding from the lungs, which horses do when they run. Not every horse, but some horses. And that actually has nothing to do with breakdowns. There is no scientific or medical evidence that the use of Lasix has anything to do with breakdowns. But the Stronach Group, Santa Anita, believes that people do not want to see horses running on medication. And frankly, in the rest of the world, there is no race day medication. It's only in the United States. But the protocols that I think are more, germane at this point is what they do before the horse runs. How many times a vet has to look at a horse? I think currently it's like four, and the vet now has to sign off to say they actually did look at the horse. And in the racing office, they're looking to see if there's anything in the past performances of the horse that would put it more at risk or at greater risk than otherwise. So it's mostly these protocols, race day medication, that they want to see, as much evidence as they can as to whether it would it's having any impact.
Do we know what's going on, John? Because this has been happening now that we have 29 horses, and we were doing a little research last year. Apparently, 39 horses died at Santa Anita. This was in the 2018, with the racing year, right?
Yeah, and also too, remember Santa Anita was off for like 3.5 weeks. And there's also at least another 4 to 6 week meeting in November. So that 39 figure includes the entire year. We are at 29 with, maybe 6 to 8 weeks left to race. As for what's going on, the absolute best case scenario is if they were to test the track and they say, oh, look at X on the track, that's what's causing it. But what it appears to be is multifactorial. And I think the number one might have been weather. the sealing and unsealing of a track. The track, when it's sealed, means it's compressed to keep the water from getting into the ground to make it muddy. And that makes it a very hard surface for horses to run on, and they might develop microfractures that would show up later. That's number one. Number two, I think, is a culture. I believe over there they created a culture where they wanted to err on the side of running as opposed to not running. And if you have that sense that you should be running your horse, you may not be as diligent as normal, which leads to number three, which is the introduction of protocols to make sure that that horse is capable of running on that day. And I think those are what they're probably going to come out with to be the factors. But, you know, we'll have to wait till the investigation's over.
Horses die at the track every year. I mentioned 39 last year. We're up to 29 this year. Do you think there's any reason? And I've been a journalist in Southern California for quite a while now. I don't remember this much notoriety going on at Santa Anita and the horses that have died. Is there something different this year?
Well, I think what's different is that people have changed over the last 10 years. The whole idea that it's acceptable that horses die in horse racing is maybe not there anymore. The animal has risen in our consciousness, and we're not as forgiving to this as it used to be. Now, you have to remember, and this is really staggering, is that fatalities in horse racing in California are down 60% in the last 12 years. So think of the staggering number of horses that were dying before. However, in fairness, too, there were more tracks running than there are right now. So I think it's just people are saying, oh, wait a minute, I didn't know that many horses died, or they just didn't know. I think that is part of the public perception problem that they're having. Racing has a perception problem.
Do you think all of these factors could really hurt or be a threat to the future of horse racing as a whole?
Absolutely. I mean, if they do not curb the number of fatalities, I think the sport is in real trouble. Now, one thing for us to look at is next year is the possibility of a ballot initiative that would end horse racing in California. As you know, California has a pretty low bar to pass a ballot amendment. It's just 50% plus one. But the first thing they have to do is get 635,000 signatures. And then, you know, there has to be the financing of a campaign. And I think the horse racing industry is certainly willing to put up $50 to $100 million to fight any kind of ballot initiative. And then finally, horse racing is not that much on the consciousness of people. Maybe 40% of the population actually have an opinion on it. And as you know, if you're voting on an amendment, you're looking at all those crazy amendments. If you don't really know anything about it, you're more likely to vote no than yes. No than meaning against the abolition of horse racing. So it's a tough road for them to go to abolish horse racing, but it is a possibility.
John Sherva writes about horse racing for the LA Times in a pretty tenuous time for the horse racing industry. John, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Well, coming up, Orange County joins L.A. County in a jump in homelessness. Find out why the numbers are up in O.C. On the other side of this, it's Greater L.A. on KCRW. This is Greater L.A. on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiotakis. L.A. County isn't the only place in Southern California that's seen its homeless numbers jump. Back in January, the County of Orange reported nearly 7,000 homeless people living in shelters or on the streets. But now, CalOptima, that's the agency that handles the OC's Medi-Cal program, has come out with its own estimate, and it's found that as many as 10,000 of its own members could be homeless in Orange County. Gustavo Arellano is here with KCRW's OC Lion. Hey, Gustavo.
Hola, Steve.
So Orange County did its homeless count back in January, this official count. Why would CalOptima do its own separate count?
They're in charge of course, administering health insurance to the poor and needy Medi-Cal, so they just want to be as accurate as possible. So what they did, though, they are not using the definition used by the federal government for homelessness. They're also, what they're saying is, like, we just estimating our clients and those clients that don't have a permanent address or have a place to stay, we're defining them as being homeless. That just helps us better administer what we're supposed to do. In other words, that just helps us do our job better.
So that's why the results are different, is because there's a different sort of algorithm and what is defined as being homeless.
Yeah, and not only that, you know, the official count comes from these programs that are called Point in Time. So it happens every 2 years. The media does this big brouhaha about it. Volunteers, they go all around Orange County. They go through ditches. They go back in the days in the riverbed. They go to parks. And they try to do a one-night estimate of how many homeless folks are in Orange County for just that one night. But with Cal Optima, what they're saying is, like, look, we're relying, instead of a bunch of volunteers going around trying to figure something out, we're just going to go by the data that we have, which, you know, we've been doing this data for years and years and years. So it's pretty revolutionary in this sense that it not only has a bigger number, but at least according to Cal Optima, it's going to be a more accurate count of who really is homeless in Orange County.
Cal Optima recently also launched its own medical care street teams. Tell us about those. What does that mean?
These street teams have basically data in front of them that says these are the people, our clients, who want health care. We know this. Instead of them going around asking people, do you want health care? And basically wasting their time by trying to help people who don't want the help. They're going to, they're targeting their resources and their people and their manpower and woman power, of course, to go out and do this. Again, for at least it seems the way Cal Optima is pushing this is that we're trying to be as efficient as possible to tackle a problem that's really, really big and has been increasing in Orange County for years.
We know there's this back and forth going on in Orange County with the cities in Orange County with this judge, David O. Carter, who's told these folks in Orange County, you got to do something about this homeless problem. What's been the reaction to civic leaders there about this larger count?
They're not happy with it. In fact, there was a supervisor, Michelle Steele, who sits on Cal Optima's board of trustees, and she basically accused Cal Optima of doing the same work that the county already did. In other words, being inefficient. There's been a big battle between Cal Optima and the board of supervisors for years and years and years, essentially trying to have more of a say in what Cal Optima does, and Cal Optima workers trying to push back against different supervisors because it looks embarrassing. The county says 7,000 homeless. Cal Optima, this board, says, no, it's actually 10,000. It doesn't look good for the headlines, and it looks like the County of Orange doesn't know what it's doing in tackling the homeless issue.
How much of this, Gustavo, is Cal Optima saying, let's try and get around the red tape. Let's get around the bureaucracy of the county itself, and let's do our own count to really get into the weeds of what's going on?
That's exactly what it is in many ways. If you're coming out with this bigger figure, then you're basically telling the county you're not able to do your job, even though you have way more resources than us. Us as Cal Optima, we're smaller, yet we have a more accurate count because we don't have as much bureaucratic red tape or we don't have as much politicizing. With the County of Orange, again, they've been trying to ignore this problem for way too long. And sure, now they're spending more money. But years ago, they had the opportunity to nip this at the bud. They did not do that. Instead, now they have to deal with the repercussions. They have to deal with the desmadre, the big, huge mess that they caused because of their inaction a long, long time ago. And of course, the people who suffer the most are the homeless, but also residents who are increasingly angry about the quality of life in their neighborhoods. And it's all the politicians' fault.
You mentioned how mindful people are in Orange County about the homeless situation in L.A. County, right? So do they look at that and are like, ugh, We don't want our solution to be anything like the quote-unquote solution that's going on up there.
Orange County, of course, has had a long-time superiority complex over L.A. County, saying, oh, we don't have homeless here. We don't have poverty here. Again, I do have sympathy for residents who now have homeless folks coming into their neighborhoods and affecting their quality of life. But at the same time, these people have lived in a bubble. They have this NIMBYism where they do not want more affordable housing in their neighborhoods or more apartments being built, for instance, in Huntington Beach, where they've been fighting against apartments for years and years and years. But what happens if you don't have places where people could live, the homeless issue is going to rise. I mean, it is, as I said earlier, it is a perfect desmadre in Orange County. Like the old Crosby, Stills, and Nash song went, nobody's right if everyone's wrong.
Gustavo Arellano, writer for the LA Times, joins us here every week on Greater LA. Gustavo, thank you.
Gracias.
or Buffalo Springfield. That's going to do it for us today. Next, it's The Business with Kim Masters. Tomorrow on this program, the Methodist Church grapples with gay clergy and marriage equality. Could there be a schism going forward? We're going to take you to two very different congregations right here in Greater LA. Catherine Barnes, Sonia Geis, Phil Richards, Ray Guarna, and Christian Bordahl are all instrumental in bringing you this program each and every day. You can stream our show anytime at kcrw.com/GreaterLA or subscribe to wherever you get your podcast. We'd love to see you there, and we'd love to be in that inbox, too. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Thanks for the ear today and for your time. Let's do it again tomorrow.